Welcome to Radio Chronicles, KPFA's program featuring regular folks telling their true stories. I'll be your host this evening, Eric Klein. I spent a good chunk of my free time this week gathering the true life stories of my friends, contemporaries, neighbors, and strangers, and it'll be my pleasure to share them with you over the next hour. First story is told by Anthony Sandberg, president and founder of OCSC Sailing in Berkeley. In addition to teaching people to sail, one of the favorite parts of his job is organizing trips to Antarctica. He's been 5 times now, and he plans a 6th visit later this year.
It's something that is now just become a pilgrimage to the most beautiful place on Earth. There in the southern hemisphere's summer, which is our winter, essentially November, December, January, February, the sun never sets. The temperature is right around 30 degrees. And you see the most abundant and most pristine wildlife, I think, that's available anywhere on Earth. And so we go out of the very south tip of Argentina, a small town called Ushuaia, where ships provision, get fueled, and then take off past the Horn, the famous Horn, and do the 600-mile passage called the Drake's Passage from the south tip of South America to the north tip of South America to the Antarctic Peninsula. We go down for 2 or 3 weeks, not just to see it, but to be there and be in it, because we take a small Russian ice-hardened ship. So it's not an icebreaker, but it's a ship that's designed to really handle the heavy conditions, both of the sea and the occasional encounter with chunks of ice, and actually often break our way into shore, finding ourselves in a position to really get off the boat and kayak, ski, ice climb, snow camp, up close and personal with the Antarctic continent and the animals. Of course, there are hundreds of thousands of penguins and thousands of seals. I was trying to sleep, but of course the sun never sets, so you can wear a bandana over your eyes to try to get a few hours sleep. But I found that I was by myself. Everybody else was snoozing. So I got out of my tent and went down to the ice floe right on the edge of the water and just sat there and meditated for a few minutes, when all of a sudden up popped out of the water right in front of me, maybe 3 feet away, a leopard seal. Now, the leopard seal is essentially the lion or the top predator of the Antarctic continent. So they get up to 10, 12 feet. Weigh, 1,500 to even 2,000 pounds, have jaws that could pretty much take you in their mouth, and they have killed divers there and others. At any rate, 3 feet away, this one pops up. Curious, though, kind of more like a giant Labrador retriever, and it takes the play pose and leans forward to me. I, in my ignorance, thought that was just playful, so I leaned forward to it, and we played essentially peekaboo for about an hour and a half, where it would dive under the water, come back up, see if I was still looking at it, go back away, swim further and forward, yawned a few times so I could see its beautiful big teeth, and I thought I was just having the most magnificent human-animal encounter possible. I certainly was thrilled with it, and then at one point I think it just tired or wanted to go off and eat a penguin's as their favorite food, so it disappeared. When I got back to the camp, our ice guide was kind of desperate because I was missing from my tent. I told him about the wonderful man-animal thing, and he just said that it was really lucky that I didn't turn my back on the animal when it was there, because that would have been the flight response that would have initiated the eating response on the part of the leopard seal.
So after a few random hours of kind of joking around with my new roommate, this was around August 4th of 2008, my final year of undergrad, and I had a new roommate, a new apartment, and it was it was our first night in the apartment, And I made my way over to my bed around 1 a.m. And my room was still completely cluttered with boxes. My bed was on the floor. I didn't have a bed frame. And we were such amazing apartment shoppers. We'd actually we were renting an apartment that faced a brick window, or rather a brick building. So, we hadn't installed our curtains yet or anything. It was pretty, a very lackluster apartment at that point. But, you know, we were tired. It was the first day we just moved in. And I just kind of made my way to bed. And it was a few weeks before school had started. And I thought it was about a week or two before school started. So I figured that, you know, kind of start revising Arabic since my program, you know, required for me to know Arabic. So I just sat down in bed and, you know, revised a bit of Arabic, got, you know, and then after I hit the fourth chapter of the Arabic textbook, I just kind of, you know, looked over at my clock and it was 2 a.m. And I was like, all right, like I need to pass out. The next day I was going to a barbecue early in the morning. I was like, all right, Sana, you know, time to pass out. And I was just so exhausted. And I turned off the lights and fell onto my bed and just completely, I fell asleep before, like as soon as my head, you know, met the pillow, I'd fallen asleep. I woke up and my eyes kind of quickly struggled to see what was happening around me. It was very dark, and something had awoken me. I heard someone talking outside. I lived on the second floor of the building, and I heard someone talking outside. And we lived also around an alleyway, so I figured that it was probably just someone who was in the alleyway talking. I mean, it was a Saturday night that night, so it was like nothing major. But the voice sounded as though it was really close by. And I was completely drowsy, and I was just so tired. And just, you know, again, lying in bed. My bed was also about a foot from the window. It wasn't that far. And I just kind of looked up at my window, and my heart stopped. There behind my, you know, naked, curtainless window, there was this shadow staring right down at me. His hands were spread around my window, and he was kind of just searching. I was terrified, but I was still in this sleepy haze, which was, you know, increasingly, you know, fading away, but still I was a bit dazed, and I just kind of croaked to him, "Hello?" And he just stopped fidgeting with my window, and my window was also open because it's summer, and summer is in Montreal really hot, so, you know, it was all there was just this, you know, a very thin separation between us. Those what they call just a grill of sorts, or not the grill, but like those mosquito net type things. And he stopped fidgeting and he just asked me, "What apartment is this?" And I, replied like a frozen idiot, 208. And he responded, "Oh, I'm sorry." He's like, "Oh, you know what? I live on the other side. Yeah, and, you know, sometimes I get locked out. So I use the fire escape to find my window. My window doesn't usually have a screen, so I was confused as to what the hell the screen was doing here. I'm so sorry." And I'm just staring at him like, whoa, okay, all right. I'm just staring at him at this point. And he just turned and walked up the fire escape, because that was the other thing. My outside my bedroom window was the fire escape. So he just turned up to walk, and he walked up, and I could not believe what had just happened. And I was like, half of my body was kind of turned toward the window, and I was just staring up at where he had been, and I was like, what just happened? And then he returned, and he, you know, rested his arms on my windowsill, and I was like, oh my gosh, what is he doing? I just, again, I was in complete disbelief at the fact, I'm like, this isn't a dream, because I'm a little too freaked up to, you know, be dreaming. This is not like dream fear. This is like, holy crap, this is real life fear. And he just kind of, you know, he put his arms on the windowsill and his shoulders kind of perked up a bit and then went down and perked up again. And what was actually really terrifying was the fact that because my room was completely dark, but there was a light outside the windowsill which came into the apartment room, which into the room, so he could see exactly what I looked like. The light fell right onto me. But because of the same reason, he was a shadow, and that was absolutely terrifying. So he said, hey, I'm sorry. I really hope I didn't freak you out. I just want to talk to you right now to make sure you're okay. And while he's saying this, I realized there was something about his speech wasn't completely slurred, but there was a bit of a slur in his speech. And I couldn't believe, but at this point, I was just like, wait, this guy actually wants, he's talking to me now? Like, why isn't he going back up to his apartment? And so I was just like, yeah, I'm okay. You know, I just moved from a really sketchy area, and you standing in my window at 4 a.m. isn't exactly the most calming sight. You know, I should really go back to bed. And before I could even finish my sentence, you know, saying that I need to go back to bed, he just asked me, like, hey, are you working tomorrow? And I was really confused because tomorrow, I'm guessing he meant was Sunday because this was Saturday. This was Sunday morning at 4 a.m., but I mean, in the context of, it was Saturday night, quote unquote. So, but at the same time, like, there was something about his tone which really concerned me, and I kind of understood it, you know. I mean, I've spoken to enough guys to understand sometimes where the tone is leading to. And so I just lied, and I'm like, yeah, I'm working. And he's like, so what time? And I was like, 9 a.m. Oh, sorry, he said, what time? And I'm like, till 9 a.m. And he's like, at 9 a.m., he's like, till when? And I was like, whenever, probably late evening, you know, I'm like, I work for an NGO, so like, I kind of get to determine my own hours. And it was a bit of a short hesitation, and I could kind of hear him think about what, you know, to say next, hear him debate. And then, honestly, I think just he made complete use of whatever remaining liquid courage was within him. And he said, listen, I'm thirsty, and you're probably still freaked out. Do you want to, I don't know, like, grab a drink of water together? Or something. And my eyes bulged in complete shock. I could not believe, like, I was shocked. Not that this guy was standing in my window or, like, you know, at 4 a.m. Trying to get into my apartment. Rather, that he had, like, the audacity to be like, hey, want to grab a glass of water together? And I just kind of nervously, you know, chuckled and was like, no thanks. I need to get back to bed. I'm not thirsty. And he persisted. He's like, well, I am. Let's grab some water. And I said, no, seriously, I think you need to go now. And he's like, whatever. And shrugged and went up the fire escape and never really found out who the shadowy figure was, but I'm pretty sure I ran into him a couple of times in the laundry room. Quite a charmer.
That true story was told by Sana Saeed, grad student and freelance writer in Montreal. Sana contributes to the blog Kabob Fest, that's KABOBFest.com. More true stories from the people who live them coming up. This is Radio Chronicles. If you want to tell your story on Radio Chronicles, or tell me what you think of the show, go online to crowsnestradio.com. More detailed information about the music played on the show is up there as well.
Okay. My name is Richard Morrison, and I graduated from University of Oregon in 92 with a degree in anthropology. And after climbing out of the Grand Canyon, I gave myself permission to travel to India, which was in a way, a graduation present. And after going through the thick and thin of various things like crossfires in Kashmir and mountaineering in Ladakh, which is northern India by Tibet, I landed in Rishikesh, and which is kind of a mecca for yogis and travelers, and was sort of settling in what we classically consider like traditional India. And after about 2 months or so, I picked up a sitar and was practicing that and getting really focused, you might say. And around the same time, there was this far out guy, looked like Bob Marley, that was living in our ashram. His name was Bhikkha, which means like beggar. And he was kind of rough character. In any event, we were a little bit at odds. He was kind of womenizing, and I wasn't really, but he thought I was. And anyway, one night I kind of just fearlessly went into his room because there was a bit of a gathering, and I was trying to let go of any of my assumptions. And it just so happened there was this beautiful sadhu. His name was Mil Mil Baba, which means mixes with people. And this guy was intense. And I brought the didgeridoo and was playing didgeridoo. And anyway, it turned out to be a great night, and like all this other sort of garbage from the past had fallen away. Anyway, Mill Mill wanted me to come see his cave. We got in this truck, and the whole time I was a little concerned, like this sadhu. There are a lot of like charlatans in India, and this guy was just going to try to milk me for, you know, some money and stuff like that. So there's this tension. And so we got up there to Nilkanth, and I didn't know what was going to happen next. We got some stuff called barfi, which was like some sweets, milk sweet. And then we set on this road, and it turns into a narrow trail. We got to the edge of this jungle, and then the sadhu guy bent down, and he offered some special things for the, I guess it felt like the jungle spirit. And anyway, we continued on. It led me to this incredible cave, and there were a bunch of other people there, two Europeans actually, that had sort of tossed off their Western style and become like bona fide Indians. There was this really ethereal woman from Germany, and she spoke fluent Hindi and a little Sanskrit and a bunch of languages, English, no problem. And so she became kind of a translator. Anyway, so I got to go to this cave dwelling in India. It's a more of a large mouth, and it, and you know, went in about, I don't know, 20 meters or so, and then went up about 20 meters. So that's like, you know, 60 feet and 60 feet up. And there was an opening on the very top, so kind of a crown opening, you might say, but very small. So, you know, if it rained, the water would come down through the cave, apparently. And fortunately, it didn't rain when I was there, but it had been used continuously for perhaps, 5,000 years, something amazing, because it was in a very famous like location considered to be kind of a mythical pilgrimage spot near a town called Nilkanth, which means blue throat. It's associated with Shiva. Anyway, the Baba that ran the place, he used to run a restaurant, and he had sort of tough luck and had given up on life, essentially. He was drinking too much, I think, and this was a story he told. And he was in a cemetery, and like he was about to, you know, compost into the ground, and this incredible like goddess woman, you know, so not like, you know, a young woman, but like a motherly type, showed up with this giant like cart of food and like nursed this guy. This was like his kind of geez, I really don't know what's happening kind of experience. And then after that, he had become a sadhu, which is like a wandering ascetic. Anyway, luck had brought him to this cave, and I guess he had the wherewithal to do it. Things kind of happen spontaneously in India, where there's just like, you know, you hear all kinds of miraculous stories about how somebody suddenly is like, you know, the guardian of the special hill or the temple or whatever. Somebody just becomes special because they sit still for so long, and then they build a temple around them and they keep sitting there. Anyway, this cave was kind of like, I consider it to be like the Eagle Scout of like asceticism. I learned so much about how to camp and survive on almost nothing. They would use the ashes from this fire. It was this very beautiful, clean setup they had. Hygiene was just like of the utmost importance. There were some flies, but mostly there was bees that came down from a beehive that was situated right above the cave, so up about 30 feet from the entrance. And it was sort of northeast facing, so it was very cool, very calm. They would use these ashes anyway from the fire pit to clean their dishes and to sterilize whatever their hands. And you know, they don't use toilet paper, they use water, and then, you know, clean with ashes. And in the morning would wash thoroughly at a spring, which was conveniently located about, I don't know, 100 yards or so from the cave. It was a very wild place, you know, where there were Monkeys would come by, exotic birds, ravens would land. You know, it felt very biblical. The routine, like say in the morning, would be to get up and these people smoked a fair amount of hash. But, you know, not like all the time, but they would do it twice a day, like pretty, you know, enough to, you know, really change your state of mind. And so I learned, I think, from professionals how to deal with a substance. I've never been able to really replicate what they did. It's somehow just between the cave, the ashes, the fire that had been burning for 12 years continuously, and, you know, ravens, monkeys, and the history. You know, it just doesn't, you can't do what you get over there, hear it. But they would anyway ceremoniously pack this chillum and light it up with a coal, very ceremoniously pass it around, muttering things like, you know, Bum Shiva or Alak Bum or Om Namo Narayan, these things that mean like, you know, everything's finished, you know, my mind's clear, you know. It's kind of a Zen thing, you know, kind of like destroying the illusion and opening that, you know, everything's this sort of fresh becoming. We don't have any real control about what, you know, the universe is. We're just little ants, you know, more or less, and we have to open our eyes. Like the Baba, who Mil Mil Baba, who means mixes with people, what he was saying that was profound, I think, was like, if we think we know, we don't know. That was one of the things he muttered, was like, I do not know good mantra. And one of the funnier things he said was that his whole meditation was, how do you do? And then the German woman that lived there, she looked like some kind of like elfin angel, like who smoked a lot of cigarettes, and her face was like covered in ash all the time. She had these kind of intense, you know, just intense everything. She goes, what he means is that his meditation for the last 12 years has been, who am I? This is a recurring theme with, you know, mystics. Who am I? But I kind of felt that I was able to lift off a lot of dross of the world that was burdening me by just participating in these ceremonies, the simplicity of the cooking, and, you know, forgiveness is really a big, huge teaching that they had. So, I mean, even though there was this hash stuff happening there, which normally would make me feel a little muddy and confused, the meditation and the simplicity of the whole thing gave me this like real clarity. And I left after being there for a week, and when I got back to the villa, Rishikesh area, I've been playing a chess master in chess for about 2 months prior, and I sat down and played him, and I creamed the guy. And it was like, wow, like, I'd never, like, if I had, like, been sloppy, smoking hash with all the tourists, blah, 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 you know, playing music, maybe eating, maybe not eating, you know, there's a lot of maybes. And in this cave, it was, like, really clear, like, everything was kind of kept up in a fairly, almost like, you know, you have corporate dialogues, you know, in the executive office, you know, with people visiting to, you know, listen in on what important things they have to say. Well, the cave was kind of like the executive office for these ascetics, where God was listening. And so this idea of satsang, or, you know, speaking truth, was sort of like a constant element that was kind of hovering over us.
Thanks to Richard Morrison for sharing his story. This is Radio Chronicles. I'm your host this evening, Eric Klein. The song you're hearing is called Making Waves. The band is called Tape, or more specifically, Dot Tape Dot, or if you like, Punto Tape Punto, since the artist Daniel Romero is from Spain. The composition comes by way of the incredible Free Music Archive from WFMU, freemusicarchive.org. Let's hear another one from Anthony Sandberg, friend of leopard seals when he's in Antarctica, and teacher of sailing when he's out on the bay. Anthony's next story reminds us that traveling to India to live in a cave with a beautiful German woman and smoke hash on a daily basis is just one of the many ways we can discover new things about ourselves.
People go through dramatic changes in their personality when they learn how to sail. I think it's the same with any activity. You become a tennis player, a skier, or, for all I know, a bridge player. There's a levels of challenge and there's discipline, but from that comes confidence. And there's an interesting thing that happens when folks choose new activities. I personally, because, a big part of my job is to bring the state-of-the-art best practices in the world of training and coaching and sports to my company, I take up new activities every year. So over the years, I've learned to fly and ski and surf and paraglide. And this year, the two big sports are road biking, which I really haven't ridden a bike in 30 years. And now I'm in the process of being coached by a top triathlete coach and learning how to really approach the equipment and the sport in my body in a brand new way. And the other one, far more challenging and scary, are tango lessons. But the embarrassment and the anxiety I feel on the dance floor is greater than I do when I'm going to the gym. One fellow who came, I guess it was really fully 30 years ago, it was in my first year of business, and we'll call him Andre. Andre went through our core courses, could handle the boat perfectly well, tie the knots, scored well on the written test of rules of the road, navigation, set the boat up properly and so forth. His big challenge was that he just couldn't be heard. When he gave commands, they just came out as an unintelligible mumble, and there was no volume, so you couldn't even anticipate the intention of what he wanted to say. So my instructors came back to me and said, look, he's doing everything right, but he'll never be able to communicate to anyone else on the boat. And I just don't feel right signing him off and calling him a skipper. What can we do? And I said, well, let me handle this. I think I can go out with him and do that. So I took him out on a boat, just on a private basis, just the two of us. And I said, Andre, you've got everything down, except we can't understand you. We can't hear you. And when these maneuvers happen, you have to be able to talk to the whole crew. So we're just going to practice. I want you to talk to me, and we're going to get up to a point where you're yelling at me, and then we'll find the right tone, the right balance for you. So we went out, set up the boat, and went out in a moderate day and tacked back and forth, so tacking coming through the eye of the wind, changing the wind's direction from being on the one side of the boat to the other. So we're making progress upwind, so we're tacking. And the commands are really straightforward. It's ready about, helms the lee. So ready to come about. So you're really asking your crew, are you ready to come about? Are you ready to do what's necessary in handling lines to bring the jib from one side of the boat to the other? That's what the short version of that is, ready about. From your crew, you would then hear ready or no, we're not ready. Got a tangle here and need to get that done. But if you're ready, you say ready, and then the skipper says helms the lee. We do that. Over a period of an hour, it goes from unintelligible to his essentially shouting it out. He's going, ready about, helms the lee. He's really gotten it. I can see just brightness in his eyes. I don't think he's ever been able to speak so clearly or be so commanding in his life. And as we're sailing along, we pass this older couple, both silver-haired and looking a little crotchety, frankly. And we sail right past them, and he leans over and says, eat wake, losers. And at that point, I said, Andre, I think we've just about hit the high volume mark of your thing. Now we're going to back it down from that, because that's a little harsh for people who aren't in your boat, or even if they are. But Andre went on to continue to sail with us for another 15 years. And I don't think that old couple we passed that he yelled out to will ever get over it.
Thanks again to Anthony Sandberg of OCSC Sailing. The song is Bad Banana Bread from the CSC Funk Band, brought to you by the miracle of Creative Commons and the website freemusicarchive.org. We'll hear more from the CSC Funk Band coming up in the next story. This is Radio Chronicles on KPFA, 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno. I'm your host this evening, Eric Connor. Up next, San Francisco-based stand-up comedian Joe Klosek. Joe hosts a monthly storytelling show in the city called Previously Secret Information. This is his true life tale that he likes to call the cow story.
So this happened in the late 90s when bands like Pearl Jam and Smashing Pumpkins ruled the airwaves, and they called it alternative, but it was really like heroin rock. Everything was just depressing and loud, and I loved it. I was a new stand-up comic, and that meant more than anything that I traveled. I would get these packages of tours that would keep me out for a month and a half easily on the road. And when I say a tour, I really mean I was driving from one town to another town. And oftentimes I could be in a different state every night. So what would end up happening is I would get into my car and I would drive 300-400 miles, you know, 8-10 hours. I would get to the gig, and this could be someplace in Montana or Wyoming or Nevada. I worked every state west of the Mississippi in a 6-month period, including Alaska. I didn't drive there though. And you would drive to these redneck bars in the middle of nowhere, which just smelled of beer and stale shame. And the crowd would be angry because they would just look at you like, I can't play foosball while this guy's telling me jokes. And then I would always get, I'm from San Francisco. And then the gay jokes would start. So many times I would go, why am I doing this? And I would get off stage. I would get drunk and go back to my hotel room with crunchy carpeting and sleep, get up early, get back in the car, drive 300-400 miles, get on stage, tell jokes, get heckled with gay jokes, get drunk, go to bed. So what ended up happening was I felt like I was really being paid to drive my car, and I had to tell jokes before I could sleep. So the art was really starting to get knocked out of me, and I was really just, why am I doing this again? Like, why? And I didn't have an apartment. I was on the road so much, it didn't make sense to me to have an apartment to send rent checks back to. So all I owned in the world was a wardrobe that consisted of 3 pairs of jeans and 5 or 6 shirts, I think 1 pair of socks, if I'm honest about it, and my car and other worldly possessions in the car. That was it. That's all I owned. So as I started to go, geez, what am I doing with my life? I also realized, geez, I'm kind of stuck in this now. Also, I should mention, there's a girl. Because what great story doesn't have a girl? And of course, like all great stories, this girl broke my heart. Now, at the time when I met her, I was a new comic, and she thought that was awesome. And she was perfect. She was beautiful, she was young, and she was sarcastic. Which meant when the time came, she just splayed my heart open with an X-Acto knife. But I fell madly in love. So, of course, it was this brief period. And at the beginning of the torrid one-month love affair, she goes, hey, I'm leaving for Spain in a month, so nothing serious can happen. So, of course, everything serious happened. And she leaves. I'm miserable. That's why I hit the road so hard, just going, fine. I'm just going to tell jokes and not think about her. Well, here's the problem. I also didn't have a car with a CD player, so I was alone with my head for hours at a time. There's no radio out in those parts of the country. I mean, there is if you want to hear about Jesus or you like Spanish polka music. Those are like your two choices, and every now and again, Rush Limbaugh. And I can vividly remember being incredibly depressed once, driving my car, and on the radio, this message comes on and it says, do you ever feel lonely? Yeah, I do. Do you ever feel like nobody gets you? Absolutely. Yeah. Then you should come on out to the stand-up comedy show tonight starring Joe Klosik. I heard an ad for my own show and I was starting to get cheered up, and when I realized it was me, I was like, oh my God, they have no idea how suicidal I am right now. I'm considering swerving into oncoming traffic, but no, I have to go do this show. They have no idea what I pulled off that night, because of course I went on stage, it's great to be here. No, it wasn't. No, I was miserable. I just wanted to tell my jokes, get heckled with gay jokes, drink, and go back to bed so I could get up and start the whole thing over again. It's a week and a half before Christmas. I don't have any gigs until right after Christmas. It seems like too long of a journey to drive all the way home to San Francisco. So I figure, all right, I grew up in the Midwest. I had a fascination with deserts because out there it's just corn and narrow thinking. So I thought, all right, I want to see a desert. I'm in Utah. I want to go see Arches National Canyonland, which is amazing. But I've always wanted to see Valley of the Gods. And everybody has seen it. You see the photos of it everywhere, you know, those tall mesas and buttes, and it's just gorgeous looking. So to get there, you have to drive through Utah on a county road that is designated 666. So to get to Valley of the Gods, you have to drive on Highway 666. Somebody had a sense of humor. That's just grand irony. So I'm driving, and the whole area is open range country, which means cattle wander freely. There's no fences. I slow my car down. The sun is starting to set, and I'm going through canyons, and I slow down to about 40, and shadows are everywhere. I'm tired, hungover. Don't judge. We don't know. And I see cows, so I slow down more. Long story short, in the middle of the road, I think I see something, but I'm not sure. And I'm moving towards it, 40 miles an hour, which doesn't seem too dangerous. And I can't decide, what is that? Is that a shadow? Is that a rock? Is that, oh my God, it's a cow. So at the last second, I spin my wheel, but I hit the cow. Yeah, that's, everyone's always feel sorry for the cow. That always amazes me. It's like, yes, the cow got hit. Actually, it got hit in the jaw too. I gave it like a glancing blow with my windshield. I just remember seeing the saddest, biggest brown eye of my life. And then the windshield shatters and it knocks the car off the road into the drink. The car spins. The rocks act as a can opener and start peeling parts of the car off, wheels, the passenger door, everything's coming apart. Then I hit another rock and the car flips end over end. And some point in that flipping, the gas tank goes, hey, let's explode too. Let's just really lay it on. So this all happens in maybe 2 seconds, but I feel the heat in the back of my head and I realize I am in trouble. Well, the car comes to rest perfectly upright, facing in the direction I came from on Highway 666, which I always took to mean the universe going, you're not ready for Valley of the Gods, turn around and go back. But here's the thing. The car is totaled. Three of the wheels completely removed, huge gashes in the side of the car, gas tank has exploded. I hear popping and ticking and hissing. I can see my worldly possessions scattered everywhere, but me, not a hair out of place, not a bruise, not a scratch, nothing, but I'm in shock. So I'm sitting there with my hands glued to the steering wheel. Unknown to me, there were two hunters in a Winnebago who were coming the other direction who witnessed the whole thing. They stop, run out, and this guy runs up to my car and pounds on the window. And here's my state of mind. I'm going, I don't know him. He's a stranger. I'm just going to crack the window an inch. And he goes, hey, are you okay? And I go, yeah. And then I turn, roll the window up, and put my hands back on the steering wheel. I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but that made perfect sense. Then he pounds on the window again and he goes, your car is on fire. You should get out. I'm like, all right, I'm going to get out. That's a good idea. So I get out and I start pulling all my worldly possessions out of the car, and literally all my worldly possessions. I'm grabbing anything I can, you know, CDs, journals, clothes, shoes, everything. At a certain point, we realize, okay, the car's not going to explode, but it's burned up pretty badly. There's a pile of my crap on the side of the road, and he looks at me and he just goes, man, really, that's a bummer, you know? I feel bad for you. I'm like, yeah, I hate that cow. And then the next thing I heard was the shiklik of a shotgun. And I don't know if you've ever been really depressed and stood next to a redneck you just met and heard a shotgun, but that does not instill a feeling of everything's going to be okay. So I look at him, and he just looks down at me and goes, let's get that cow. You know, I'm not a vengeful man, and even in that moment, I'm like, no, you know what? Shoot me. I'm the one that's really screwed here. The cow, I don't care about. But he goes, no, we have to put it down if it's in pain. We can't just leave it in the road. Somebody else is going to hit him. I'm like, fine. So we're walking down the road. Oh, by the way, he has a flashlight duct taped to his shotgun. That just screams issues I don't even want to think about, you know, just like the militia weekend was done and he was driving back. So we're going down the road with the flashlight, and he's pointing stuff with his gun, and he's going, oh, there's a piece of your hubcap, there's some fender, you know, there's a Tears for Fears CD, I never quite cared for them myself, you know, that kind of a thing. So in the middle of the road, we never found the cow, I will tell you that, never found the cow, but in the middle of the road where the cow hit it, we found the biggest pile of excrement. Can I say excrement? That I've ever seen in my life. And it was fresh. I'm not going to get graphic, but steamy and wow, that is a big pile of that. So I scared the crap out of that cow. And the cow got away. I mean, to this day, I think the cow has like a UFO abduction story that he tells his cow friends, you know, like there was a bright flash and I felt something hit me and now I woke up in this field. You know, so he's got a story. He's fine. But here was my Zen moment or my breakdown. I drop to my knees and I start laughing hysterically. And the guy is looking at me like, what's up? And I point to the pile of crap and I go, look at that pile of crap. And then I point back to my worldly possessions. Look at that crap. They're both the same. They're both just piles of crap. And this guy doesn't know what to do because this is fairly existential for a man who has a flashlight duct taped to his shotgun. So he does the only thing I think he can do. He pats me on the shoulder and goes, they're there, which I didn't think anyone actually did, you know, but it was that, you know, that's his extent of warmth and I appreciated it. I go back to the car and the guy says to me, you have to remember you're alive. You're okay. And I can see the words in my head. I'm about to say to him, but I can't do what I love anymore. And as those words are dropping onto my tongue, I realize I don't love this. I am miserable. I want to tell jokes, but not out here, not at the expense of my sanity and my life. Now everything is gone. I am not loving this. So that was my first moment of realization. Long story short, I had a hitchhike out of the desert. And my plan was to hitchhike back to I-80 interstate and hopefully pick up a ride to get to a Greyhound bus station in Salt Lake City and get home. And as I was hitchhiking through the desert every now and again, I did this in the morning and it was a just spectacular day, 60 degrees, blue sky, huge red ball of fire in the sky. And I would have to stop every hour and figure out how much these possessions meant to me because everything was getting heavy. I just had a bag. So I would take stuff out, put the bag back on my shoulder, keep on walking. And people always think, man, that must have been really depressing. This incredible feeling came over me. I've never had it since, never had it before. Everything was brand new. Like it just came over me. Like everything is brand new. Because it had to be. Everything was gone. The only thing I had was me. I was in perfect working order. Maybe not mentally, but, you know, I'm fine. I get back to San Francisco. I go back to my old job where I met this girl and I beg for my job back, which is a line cook. And they go, if we hire you, you got to work New Year's. I'm like, oh, that's such a burn for a comic because you want to work New Year's. So I'm there New Year's and the entire menu, I'm working the grill. It's filet mignon, tri-tips, New York steak. It's cow. It's all cow. So I feel like even that night, the cow is haunting me and mocking me. But who walks in? The girl. And she's walking to the bathroom. She sees me. I see her. We look at each other. And there's a whole other story involved there. But I got a lot of questions answered. And the only reason why I was back there that night was because I hit the cow. And I ended up having to stay in San Francisco. which I thought was a curse at the time, but it made me a great comic. I got a career in stand-up comedy that keeps me local and figured out some stuff about myself. And I always take the moral of the story to mean, yeah, everything was brand new when I was coming out of the desert. And just like Jesus, I found some meaning and people will now listen to me. That is the cow story.
Stand-up comic Joe Klosik. Check him out at standupjoe.com. His monthly storytelling salon-type stage show, previously secret information, will be up at Stageworks Theater in San Francisco, May 16th. The song is Funk Shop from the CSC Funk Band and freemusicarchive.org. For our last story this evening, my friends Cherie and Mike of the Sour Mash Hug Band recorded just hours ago on their sunny front stoop in Oakland.
So this is a story about the time, and this is actually when me and Mike first, well, we had met, I think, 2 years prior, but this is when we first started romancing, and we decided to go to Europe together. We had been together for like a couple months, right? And we went to Europe, and that's a whole other crazy story, one in which involves, you know, robbery, sneaking on trains, and all these other exciting things. Robbery of us, not us robbing people. It's not really how we roll. But yeah, us sneaking on trains and getting robbed and all this other stuff. And then after all that, we end up in Budapest, where Mike is reunited with his family that he's never... Well, it's not even reunited because he never met them before, right? So he meets his Hungarian family that he's never met before. And that's also a good story, but we won't go there either. But then we decide to go to Romania because we need to find this violin. And it's a special kind of violin. It's kind of like a Stroh violin, which is made in Austria and has a resonator for a horn, but it's a little different. It's kind of like a gypsy take on the instrument.
It's called the Viola di Ciamba. And it's a violin with where all the sound comes out of a brass horn. And the horn is, it's an old car horn from like, you know, antique car, and the resonation comes from the resonator for a Victrola record player. So the sound goes from the bridge to the Victrola resonator and out the car horn. And anyway, it's got a really neat
sound. It's a little bit tinny sometimes, but it's also really nice and kind of brassy. But it's a violin, you know, it's played like a violin, so it projects loud, and
it's from this region of Romania called Bihar, which is on the border of Hungary, and it was used for marching bands. So you'd have a marching band with like six of these strange horn fiddles and like some drums, just, you know, marching down the street instead of trumpets. So
we were gonna go find this horn. So right. We were gonna leave our, you know, staying with the nice Hungarian family to go on this trip to Romania, which we had, you know, a list of some contacts from some people, none of which we actually were able to get a hold of, but we went anyway, and we caught a train out, and we went. Oh, but you had looked up Roja.
Yeah, I had done some research, and at the time I didn't really know that much about where these horn fiddles were from, but I found, you know, information on someone who was talking about one and had gotten it in a place called Roja, Romania. So I tried to figure out where Roja was in Romania. And what I found was a place called Roja, Montana, which is not Roja. I'll tell you that right at the outset.
True. But that's where we went.
Yeah.
So we took the trains. Mm-hmm. And then we got into Cluj at... What, 1 a.m. or something? It was midnight. 1 a.m, 2 a.m. We get into Cluj.
Oh, right.
We're in the train station. Yeah. Nobody speaks English, and we don't know how to get to Roja, Montana. Yeah. And it was horrible. There was this one guy that was being really mean to me, and the train lady couldn't help us, like, didn't speak at all any English. We were really feeling isolated. And
yeah,
then the guy...
What? Just hanging out in the train station.
A lot
station.
Of people looking
sleeping.
Really sketchy or just sleeping in the train station. But the guy behind us in the line, we're struggling with the lady to try and figure out how to get somewhere, and she's like, I do not, you know, she doesn't even say I do not, she's not. There is absolutely no communication happening. And of course, we were younger and we didn't have ourselves as together for this kind of world travel at the time. We didn't know any Romanian in going to Romania. And but the guy behind us in line did speak English. He had studied English really hard because he wanted to immigrate.
To here,
he wanted
yeah.
to go to school. He wanted to.
And he actually got into school here.
He got into school here, and he had a sponsor. He had a teacher that was his sponsor, and everything was all like he was accepted by America, but they just denied him in Romania. They just were like, "Nah, you can't leave." And he's like, "And that is it. I'm stuck here forever now." It was very sad. But he became our travel buddy, and he took us around and helped us get to where we're going and traveled with us, and at least as far as Roja Montana. And that pretty much saved us in that junction, because otherwise we would have been...
Well, he didn't go to Roja Montana with us.
He got us close enough
He took us to the bus.
To the bus, and helped us map out our entire route, so we were no longer idiots. Well, we were still idiots, but we at least knew how to get back to, you know, home, which at that moment was the best.
Yeah.
So we get to Roja, and we start walking up this mountain.
Yeah, the bus drops us off sort of kind of near Roja Montana, and it's a long bus ride. So basically, we were rushing to the bus.
At this point, we spent 2 or 3 consecutive nights sleeping on vehicles.
Right, and
we were
rushing the bus. I think he gave us a ride to the bus, right? And then we were ordering pizza.
No, we didn't
just
have a
as
car.
The,
he got somebody else.
Someone else.
He got somebody. We had to pay them.
And anyway, and I remember we were we hadn't eaten, and we were all both really hungry, and the bus was about to leave, and otherwise we'd have to stay there the whole night, and we ordered pizza as the bus was leaving, and we might not have gotten it, but they got it done just in time. He brought it to us while we were in the bus about to take off, and so we got something to eat. Then we go on this long ride.
He saved us.
Really. Yeah, he did. Way up in the mountains, the western mountains of Romania, which are very, very old school. They're
they're like medieval.
They're you know, imagine a national forest, but people live in it. That's what I think of. You know, there's towns and everything, but it's the forest, and it's really wild.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. And what was it? Going into Romania is going backwards in time, you know, the further you get out, you know, you come in on a train, you know, maybe you fly into Europe, you come in on a train, then you get on a bus, then you get on a horse-drawn carriage, you know, it's keep going back and back.
So, we were on the bus, and we go past a village, and all these guys get on the bus, and they're all dressed in the same fedora and
little
vest.
Little tiny little hats. They all wear the little hats.
Oh, yeah, anyway, it's
but
like
they are the, little fedoras.
It's
but
like
all little.
A costume that's, you know, that village. That's what, you know, they wear at least to dress up and, you know, fancy. And they get on and then they go to the next place, you know. And people are really, really dressed very, very traditionally.
Unlike me, who at the time is in all black with dreads and a bunch of metal stuff, all these piercings in my face, which was not the best way to be traveling in Romania. People were like, "Who is that scary witch?" you could tell. The women were so scared of me. It was really bad. They all thought I was a crazy witch. It was not the best way to present myself in visiting their country. You know, just...
So anyway,
just
we get dropped off, and we're somewhere in the mountains.
No, but we knew we had to go up the hill.
We knew where we were going. There was a sign that says Roja Montana, this direction.
A couple kilometers up this hill.
And there was an old lady walking her cow on a little, rope. And the cow had a little bit of horns, and it was a wild
cows,
kind of cow.
Most beautiful cows you've ever seen in your life in Romania. They're amazing cows. I don't know. I've just never even seen a cow walk like that before. These cows, when they walk, they, shake their hips, you know? They are, cow queens. They really are. They're such sassy cows, and they just look more wild and stuff. I don't know. And they'll just walk, you know? Not everybody even walks them on a leash. Sometimes you'll just see them walking. and we were walking, because we ran into like three, no, two cows. We ran into two cows. We were walking up this hill, and it's beautiful. There's this lake running down, this river is running down the side of the hill. We're walking up the hill.
And it's just this windy gravel road.
Yeah.
Slowly going up.
And then we see the two cows, and we're like, wow, look at those cows. Those are
really good. There's like cows standing there in the middle of the
hill. They're just like, but no, they're kind of sauntering.
Out. No one's around. They're sauntering.
They're sauntering down the hill slowly. This is like, but with like, just totally like, this is my road, you know? Like, just walking down their road. They're like, huh, who are these weird people things on my road, you know? And then, like, a semi comes, and the semi has to, like, stop, and then honks at the cows, and the cows, like, turn back and give them this look, like, asshole, and, you know, slowly get out of the way.
Yeah, the semi was an odd thing, but it was definitely our first clue of what was to come in some ways.
Yeah, the semi was pretty odd. And then, but as we keep going up this river, we keep going up.
We did meet that gypsy fellow for a minute, too.
You did?
Yeah, the one he borrowed, he wanted to play my violin for a minute, and he played kind of cool stuff.
Oh,
but anyway,
yeah.
And then he wanted to buy my bow. fellow hanging around there. And then, I don't know.
As we're going up the river, as we're going up the mountain, the river all of a sudden changes colors, and it turns from this beautiful crystal blue to this, like, kind of icky, I don't know, kind of not dirtier than marigold kind of color. And we start getting to the top, to the town, and every house is abandoned. There are all these little houses, and they're all abandoned, and they all say property of what mining company was it? I don't remember the name.
It's a Canadian mining company.
Canadian,
I can't remember, a gold mining, and there's a little plaque in every in every house that says that's, and all the houses, they're like, they're just, their foundation is destroyed, like they're wrecked almost as if, I guess, so that someone can't live in them, or maybe can't squat in them or anything like that.
Yeah,
I'm not sure, but it seems very intentional. It doesn't seem like it just happened, you know. They're just abandoned, like, I don't know how, you know, they couldn't have been abandoned that long ago. The houses are still, like, at least a lot of them are still in kind of decent shape, other than that their foundation is kind of destroyed. And if you look inside, like, the floor is just all rocks and stuff like that. And
and people have defecated in them.
Right. So,
but this comes up because, as it would turn out, the town's not very friendly because there's pretty much nobody in it. It starts raining.
Right.
I think I start my period, too, just to top it off, and there's pretty much nowhere to go, and we end up sleeping in one of those houses.
Yeah. So there was one store in town, which is, like, this really tiny place.
And wasn't particularly friendly.
It wasn't friendly at all. Like,
at least not to somebody that looked like me.
But unhappy, the lady who ran it, and they, you know, they had, like, some cheese and stuff, you know, but not very much, like, a couple vegetables, some cheese, hardly anything, and that was the only store. And so then it started raining, and we looked for shelter, and what did we do? We started walking back.
We squatted one of the houses.
Yeah.
And we slept there the night, and then we took off the next day, because the town was obviously not a town that we had that would have the But
so getting there was the better part.
Yeah, getting there is the better part of the story. And then we just came back. We met some people on the way back, you know. But then we found the violin we were looking for back in Budapest the very next day.
Mike and Cherie are the Sour Mash Hug Band. Of course, the music in their story was performed exclusively for you by the Sour Mash Hug Band. Tour dates, including their upcoming gig at Cafe Royale in San Francisco, online at myspace.com/sourmashhugband. Myself, I check them out most Saturdays at the downtown Berkeley Farmers Market. Thus concludes tonight's edition of Radio Chronicles. I sincerely hope you enjoyed listening. If you have a true story to tell, you can find me at my new website, crowsnestradio.com, where there are also archives of this program. Thanks to Anthony Sandberg, Sana Saeed, Richard Morrison, Joe Klosik, and Cherie and Mike of the Sour Mash Hug Band. My name is Eric Klein. Have a nice evening.